I started at NBA 91, so that's 32 years. Kind of what have I seen and like what sticks with me, you know, right. Kind of thing. So,
welcome to The Outfall, a podcast where we explore the backstories of water and infrastructure. This is Robert, and in this episode, we get an insider's perspective on the drinking water sector from a veteran leader, Alan Roberson. Alan is the executive director of the Association of State Drinking Water Administrators. With over 30 years of experience under his belt, he draws on a deep knowledge and a fascinating interview touching on everything from regulations, past and future, to infrastructure and emerging contaminants like PFAS. We recorded this discussion this past spring. Enjoy.
Yeah, my name is Alan Roberson. I'm executive director of the Association of State Drinking Water Administrators. And that's a small nonprofit in Northern Virginia, D.C. area that is the national voice for the administrators of the drinking water programs across the country.
Maybe give us a snapshot or a little peek on what your normal day looks like.
Normal day is just covering a wide range of regulatory and legislative issues. And I start off with regulatory first because Congress is slower to move. Well, I guess regulations are slow to move too, but you know, we don't see a lot of changes to the drinking water laws, and I'll get to that later on. As opposed to the regulations, there's always different things going on and then different ways to provide input. And then there are even issues, and I'll sort of give you the current one, the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, and how the water sampling is being conducted along with air and soil sampling. You know, what it means for the assessment of the situation, the response, and then the ultimate cleanup. And so, frankly, I knew a little bit about railroads and hazardous materials, but I'm learning more, and I'm sure there'll be more to learn. So there's issues like that that I didn't foresee in January because it happened in early February. And so there are all these new issues that pop up that we have to think about and think, is this important for our members to know? And is this important for the larger drinking water community to know? So we're just another voice in the drinking water community. So it's a lot of different issues.
You know, if you could talk to your younger self, what would you tell your younger self now?
The thing that's probably surprised me the most, and it relates back to what I just talked about, is the amount of learning you have to do. You think, you know, after you've got an engineering degree, which I have, and took the AWA job in 91. I did consulting for about a decade in between. And you think that you get the hang of the job pretty quick and that it'll just be a matter of kind of turning the crank and getting the work done. But so many issues have come up. And so what I would tell my younger self is just be prepared for that. Be prepared to read, to listen. You know, conversations like this, Robert, are very important because someone's perspective may not have an impact on what you're doing at the moment, but it may have an impact next month or next year or 10 years from now. And that's one thing that I probably didn't recognize when in 1991 was how much information's in the drinking water sector and then how many new things were going to come up. I'm just amazed that the smart engineering consultants out there can design and build these things, and they work. There's a whole lot to a water plant, a surface water plant.
Sure. Know?
And so every time I go and I'm down in a filter gallery, I just go, wow, I'm glad there's smart people that know what they're doing.
What have you learned by really digging deep into the regulations and then the corresponding laws that went with them?
I think there are a couple things. One is that it's always a balancing act between trying to make them as protective of health as possible. And then the practical side of being practical, again, this is the engineer in me coming out. It's not just how do you make the cost to build and operate the treatment affordable for the communities, but how do you structure the reg for a monitoring or for compliance determinations? You know, a lot of the nuances to ensure that it's feasible for the water systems, particularly these smaller ones or even medium-sized, to stay in compliance. So that's one issue. And then The second part of that is that the challenges of staying in compliance don't just go away in the first few years after new regulation, that we're seeing a lot of turnover in the water sector. Robert, people like you and me and others that we've talked about, colleagues, you know, they're all retiring out. And so there's been a lot of turnover, and it's really across the sector. So it's at EPA, it's at my members of state agencies, it's at the consultants, and it's at the water systems. The challenges never stop.
Well, so speaking of the challenges, so what's kind of the biggest challenge in the next few years that you're trying to focus in?
I think there's really three. Well, I have a longer list, but I'll start with this three. You go beyond that, people, their eyes will glaze over. But one is just the money. And it sounds kind of funny to say money's a challenge, but it is, because the infrastructure funding, that the bill that was passed in late 21, you know, quadrupled the funding through the state revolving funds for the traditional SRF, but then for lead and for PFAS. And that's a great thing. I mean, it's historic investment in infrastructure, but it's a lot to move through the pipeline. You know, again, if you think about the different players to get a project built, you've got to have, the states have to do their intended use plans and their priority list. Then they have to make the loans, and then the water systems have to design the plans and specs. They have to do a preliminary engineering report before that to be able to get the grant. And then they do the plans and specs, and they built it, and then you start up or commission the new facilities. And that's a whole lot of work for a whole lot of people. And we're seeing the competition for young engineers, young engineering graduates, just being crazy. The second one is lead. You know, as part of that, there's $15 billion for lead service line inventories and replacements. And just replacing the 10 million, which is an estimate, lead service lines across the country is a challenge. But the real challenge is that you've got to really know the service material. I have a pretty good knowledge of the service material of 100 million service lines. And it's really 200 million data points, because you got to have both the service line material on the public side, in the street and in the right of way, and then on the private side, on the homeowner's lot. So that's a whole lot of information to try and procure in a timely manner. There are a whole lot of systems and states that are pretty lead free, and that'll help. But there's a whole lot east of Mississippi where there's a lot of lines, and a lot of lines where the knowledge is just not there. So doing those inventories and finding out when the work that you're doing to get the service line material correct is enough is something that we're working on right now. And finally, number three is PFAS. I think anyone in the water sector has become much more familiar with that acronym in the past few years. And we're all waiting at this point for EPA's proposed standards for PFOA and PFAS, and if they include some others. But we know the number is going to be low, you know, likely single digit part per trillion. And again, that's going to create challenges for the thousands of systems that'll have to put in treatment, running pilot tests, doing plans and specs, some of the tough stuff that I talked about previously. And then ultimately, the systems have to figure out how to provide the financing for that, not just for the capital cost of building the facilities, but then you have to replace the media on a regular basis, and how are you going to fund that media replacement? And ultimately, what are you going to do with all that media? So there's a lot of questions about PFAS that we're trying to work on.
What does the PFAS issue remind you of kind of throughout your history?
The most similar one, just as far as numbers, would be arsenic back in the late 90s and early 2000s.
And what started that, the arsenic?
It really had to do, there was an old arsenic standard at 50 parts per billion, and similar, you know, they did new health effects research and thought the numbers ought to be lower, instead of 50, closer to, you know, 3, 5, or 10. And EPA did an assessment and found that there were strong evidence of carcinogenicity at those low single digits part per billion. You know, again, I think they proposed alternative MCLs of 3, 5, and 10. And then the benefit and cost were a big issue, that they ended up selecting 10 as the new MCL because that was where they thought the benefits justified the cost. And I want to say they were 2,000 systems that were estimated to put in treatment. Well, that's the difference between arsenic and PFAS, is that instead of looking at parts per billion, EPA is looking at parts per trillion. Mm. And the number of systems that might be impacted is closer to 4,000 or 5,000. So the number of systems put in treatment is at least twice as many. And then I think the treatment is actually going to be more expensive on a per gallon basis, per gallon treated. And so I think, you know, that's one that is sort of comparable, but sort of not. It's naturally occurring compound. So that's one difference. And it's a little more regional. So I live in the Northern Virginia area, and there's literally like a couple systems that have, I know one, I mean, there may be another one that's put in arsenic treatment. And there are hot spots out in the Southwest, but it's not as ubiquitous as PFAS. You know, I think every state has some PFAS systems, be it from a, could be from a landfill or a manufacturer or a firefighting academy or an airport, all kinds of different issues.
And it seems like just from, with me, the more we look, the more we find it.
Like, yes.
It used to be 5 years ago, I think in South Carolina, they only had one spot, but now I'm here and it's everywhere.
And I became aware of this probably 12 or 15 years ago at AWA. I think a lady who works for a water system in Ohio sort of steered me to it. And it was downstream of one of the main manufacturing plants, the Washington Works. And it was on the West Virginia-Ohio border. And this water system in Ohio had to put in GAC. And I said, okay, it's an issue, legitimate issue. It's probably only going to be downstream of these major manufacturers. I did a little investigation. There were like 8 or 9 factories. And I said, okay, these areas will have a problem. And I was just dead wrong, because there's so many of these Air Force sites, firefighting academies, landfills, different manufacturers. And like you said, with the health effects numbers just going lower and lower, we're finding more. The more you sample, the more you find for it. So I think it's just going to be a challenge to sort out, I think, the next decade to get all the initial sampling done, to know where you have problems, and then figure out how to design and operate the treatment.
You know, what I'm curious about, and I'm sure you've heard that phrase, the black swan events, right? Mm-hmm. The unknown unknowns. Do you ever think about that in your role?
I do. I mean, I think a lot of the black swan events would be more regional problems that would impact everything. And the one example I give a lot, Robert, is the electrical grid. So if the grid went down, and everyone has power outages, and you can, you know, get by for like a couple days, you know, it's uncomfortable and it's a pain in the neck, but you can do that. But if that drags on to like 2 weeks or 2 months, it becomes very untenable very quick. And particularly now, how we've all moved to electronic banking and cashless payments. You know, I don't know about your situation, but I know my children, and they're adult children, there are times where they don't carry cash. And some of my young staff, you know, it's all credit card or debit card or Venmo or whatever it might be. And so it would definitely change daily life if, and even just some region had a power outage and was down for a week, and not just individuals, but just down, and it went to 2 weeks because, you know, refrigeration and HVAC and finance and food and drinking water, you know, systems have generators, but then fuel would become a problem pretty quick because they all usually have storage, but that has a limitation. And then you wouldn't be able to get the trucks, you know, run the pumps to get the fuel trucks to get to the refill the tanks or whatever. So those are the events I worry about. I don't know how likely that is, but it's like you said, it's this unknown unknown. What might be a problem that you really just even can't visualize very well? So
what do you think the general public kind of misses from our world, or their misconceptions?
Like going back to, I think, the complexity of a water plant.
Yep.
You know, the complexity, just the everyday, it becomes taken for granted 24/7 that you turn on the tap and that water comes out and that it's safe. And they don't realize the challenge to get it from whatever the source, be it groundwater or be it surface water,
to treat it and then even move it and maintain pressure.
Laws brewing. What do you see on the forefront that you've got your eyes on?
Yeah, there are probably a couple things that may change. I think one is earmarks came back in the last couple of years of Congress. And so they're taking money for cities lobby for specific projects. Those projects get designated by Congress to get a grant. And that money's coming out of the state revolving fund. So I think they're going to change where they get that money so it doesn't have a negative impact on the capitalization grants for the revolving funds. The other one that's kind of hanging and gets percolating occasionally is cybersecurity. Mm. And if there's a major cybersecurity attack on the water systems, I think you'll ultimately see a regulatory requirement. A couple of states have had some more like an assessment mandate, more than you have to do X, Y, Z. The problem with a regulatory framework for cybersecurity is it is changing so fast. I think the challenge is not like an NCO where you can say, hey, you have to treat atrazine to 3 parts per billion. Trying to protect against a cyber attack, you have to be on guard and evolving all the time. And so I think a regulatory framework would be really challenging. I think the DHS group that deals with that, CISA is the acronym, I think that they're developing performance goals. And I think you figure out what you need to do to achieve that goal, and it'll be tailored for water, wastewater. So I think it's in process. I think we'll have a better idea probably by the end of the 23 about that target to shoot for. So I think that way you can have different approaches to get there that still meet those performance goals.
And maybe those goals change, right, as the future changes, right? Instead of X, it becomes X. And
exactly. Yeah. It may change.
Wow. All right. So what haven't we covered that's on your mind?
I think I briefly touched on this, but it's really the workforce in the water sector. I know we've heard about this for many years on the operator side, and I think that's still an issue out there. But again, I'm just seeing the workforce. Everyone's having to go into those engineering schools and talk to the sophomores so they can intern between their sophomore and junior and senior, and they're on track to become an employee. And that's great. You're going to build the workforce that way, but that's 2 years out. And so everyone's competing for the civil engineers coming out of Clemson, you know, and other schools that have engineering programs. And it's just getting, the competition's really getting tough. So I'm hearing a lot more about workforce than I did, in a different way than I did 2 or 3 years ago. Before, it was about the operators. How do we take care of the operators, make sure we have competent operators when the boomers retire? But now I'm hearing it across the board.
Well, just talking to you, it just always still reminds me of it is a small world. The more you, and I'm sure there's more names you and I could pull out from our histories together. So,
yeah, it is a small sector. That's one thing that I've learned too, is that, you know, you always want to maintain, building and maintaining those relationships are important. And because you never know when you may need to ask somebody a question or get some information from someone that you met 10 or 20 years ago. So, right. Yeah, it's relationships are important.
Relationships are important. Getting involved with our water associations, reaching out to colleagues for lunch or coffee does pay dividends. You know, I didn't fully appreciate this when I was starting my career. Big thanks to Alan for joining us and sharing his insights garnered over an impressive 30-year career. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on any of our upcoming conversations or stories. And let us know if you have any feedback or ideas for future episodes. Until next time, thanks for listening to The Outfall.